For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, what is simple living? Well, one definition is living at the need level instead of at the greed level. It's easy to remember. That's probably pretty good. Of course, we have to define what is need. Pretty wide span of definitions there. Limiting time and effort expended for temporal things. Yeah, you can't really say how much. This isn't an objective concept, it's a subjective concept, which has to do with how much, where your emphasis in life goes. And, you know, as Christian believers, we realize that temporal things, we have to deal with them. I mean, we have to have a job, we've got to put food on a table, we've got to wear clothes. So we're certainly involved in the temporal world, but we also realize that it's just temporal. So we don't want to get too carried away with that. We try to cut down as much on that as we can so we have more time and energy and mental focus to expend on things that really do matter, like relationships, like ministry, like the things of God. Gaining freedom from excessive worldly demands and using that freedom to build a successful life. That's the strategy right there. So everything is pulling at me. I'm being pulled in different directions. I'm going to snip some of those cords that are pulling me, whatever I can get away with. That's going to give me freedom. And then I have used that freedom to build a healthy life along biblical lines. Questions come up. Is it biblical? It doesn't seem to, you don't see it taught much. You read books on Christian living, and most of them never say anything about this. The church I grew up in sure never said anything about it. And in fact, they seem to contradict it. They seem to stress that you try to be as successful as possible, and that you, your career is your ministry, that sort of thing. Strange silence on this subject in Christian literature, I think. Here and there, there's a person that speaks for it. David Platt kind of does, although he was more like he was negative on the rat race. It got a little unclear when it came to what we're supposed to do instead. That's hard not to be that way. I'm going to try to not do that. Let's look at a little scripture. Okay, 1 Thessalonians 4. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands, just as we commanded you. Then people who are not Christians will respect the way you live, and you will not need to depend on others. So that word right there, quiet, esukazine, or hesukia, the noun, to live a quiet life. If you look at that in the lexicons, it's characterized as not running around all over the place, but it's kind of a chill life. It would be kind of probably how we would translate that more idiomatically. Definitely less complicated, more simple. What he's prescribing here is fairly simple. 1 Tim 6:6. But godliness is actually a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. There's a key. For we've brought nothing into the world. Also, we'll take nothing out of it either. So, if we have food and covering with these, we should be content. There it is. That's simple living right there. I've got basic needs. I got a place to live. I got clothes. I got a car. The things I need. And so I should be content with that. He goes on. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Now, those are not imperatives there. Those are just indicative statements. But flee from these things, you man of God. There's your imperative right there. Yes, it is taught biblically. Flee from these things. And if he, as a man of God, is supposed to flee from them, I think any one man or woman of God here would feel the same thing. We need to flee from those things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, and perseverance, and gentleness, the things of God. It's in the Old Testament too. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me just enough to satisfy my needs. For if I grow rich, I might deny you and say, who is the Lord? When if I'm poor, I might steal, and then I would insult your holy name. Proverbs 30, 8 and 9, yeah. There it is. Give me just enough to satisfy my needs. Simple living. Right there. Yeah, there's quite a few other passages. Yes, yes, we could we'd definitely go on. Yeah, this, it is taught. It is biblical. And, you know, the other side, the negative side of anti-materialistic greed is really taught. That's an emphasis for sure. Notice here, by the way, this is a caveat. Give me neither poverty. Poverty is not good. That is not what simple living is. Poverty is a negative, something to be fought. In the Old Testament and the New, we're to help the poor and try to liberate them from poverty. Poverty is a form of suffering that we try to escape. The wise man avoids poverty. And of course, riches. Riches are very dangerous, extremely dangerous. Some parents want their children to be wealthy. They want them to be successful, including Christian parents. Don't they realize how dangerous that's going to be? That will capture their heart and be like, this, who, Jesus, who? I'm so caught up in my riches. It's just extremely dangerous not to be sought after and actually to be avoided. When we start getting too rich, we need to look to give more. You know who's really good on this whole area is Randy Alcorn. Money, Possessions, and Eternity. Awesome book. And balanced. And yeah, and you know, his point is God doesn't have a problem with how much you earn. The question is, how much do you keep? You can earn as much as you want. You know, if you're a medical doctor, you're going to be raking it in big time. The question is, how much of that are you going to keep and how much of it are you going to give away? Well, Jesus spoke to it. Do not store up treasures here on earth where moth eat them and rust destroys them and the thieves break in and steal. That's an imperative right there. Do not do that. Here's another one. Store up treasures in heaven where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. So these are both biblical imperatives, commands, if you like to use that language. And wherever your treasure is, there the desire of your heart will also be. That's not an imperative. That's just an indicative. That's a statement of fact. I think so many Christians try to think, well, I just think I should just store up some treasure in each. You know, some on the earth and some... Boy, well, if you can do that and successfully, then this scripture is false. And Jesus lied. On the other hand, what about retirement? There's a question. We're not going to lay up any riches on earth for retirement. We went round and round in our church about this. We decided, you know, like, for instance, I listened to George Verwer and Operation Mobilization. They decided they were not going to insure anybody. They're just going to trust the Lord. Well, now the organization has, you know, dozens, scores of old people coming out that are really too old to do that kind of work anymore. And yeah, it's causing problems. I think they've had second thoughts about it. We debated it. We decided, look, somebody's going to have to pay. You know, when you're drooling there and can't, you know, function anymore, somebody's going to have to pay the bill. And it's going to be the church, probably. It's going to feel obligated to do that. What are we just going to just throw you to the street or whatever? And one of the bad things that would happen is that we would feel unwilling to lay off or retire people that need to retire because it would be financial ruin for them if we did that. So we decided decades ago that we were going to have a retirement plan, and we put that in place. It's turned out to be a good thing. I don't think that's what Jesus has in mind. It's accumulated wealth that's basically wealth that's unnecessary. He goes on, the eye of the lamp is the body. It is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is clear, then your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And then the light that's in you is dark. When the light's within you is darkness, how great is the darkness? This is a kind of a confusing one, but it's an echo of early rabbinic teaching that we have, where they talked about the evil eye. He says, if your eye is bad, if your eye is evil, the evil eye was the coveting eye, the lusting eye, lusting in the context for riches. He says, no one can serve two masters, for either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. In the old translations, they left that word mammon, God and mammon. And I remember in Sunday school, they told us mammon was an idol, a god, false god of wealth and money. And not true. That's just the Aramaic word for wealth. There's no god by that name. And I think I almost wondered if they left it untranslated on purpose. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot. Indicative is not possible. There's your danger of wealth right there. If I can only serve one master, that wealth might suck me over into it. I'm a weak male. I'm not a strong person. I'm not big on self-control. So how would I, I don't resist other sins. How would I resist those sins? I don't know if I could. It might be very dangerous indeed. Well, let's think about some of the values that we get from a life of simple living. Relaxation. Yeah. That ability, you do go to work. You're probably going to have to work hard. Most jobs you have to work pretty hard. But then it's over, and you get to relax. And we don't need to worry about continuing to expand and puff up what we have. We can sit back. I think, that's involved and embodied in this way of life. Decreased worry. The scripture's clear that the richer we get, the more anxiety it brings. And with a simple life, we're just not worried about as many things. We are worried about the simple things, take care of those, and that's all we're worried about. More freedom. The thing that people are really feeling a lack of in our culture is time, disposable time, usable time. And every time we talk to people about the idea of true community, for example, or of discipleship, things that are kind of time intensive, require time, all of a sudden they start to kind of glaze over and look away, and we're really busy, that comes out. Too busy for the things of God. That's a life that's too complicated. We need to think about maybe downsizing. A lot of us have gotten ourselves committed to situations where our payments on everything are so high, we have to continue to perform at a very high level. We're not free to cut our income in half. We can't go in and tell our boss, I refuse the advancement and the extra stress that's going to come with that. We need that money. So we've made bad decisions. We have to see if we can backtrack on some of that. One of the main values of simple living is your family. We're basically saying that we're putting the family over the world system. putting the people of God over the world system, to engage in community, to meet together, to build each other up, to disciple one another. That's more important than excelling in the ways of the world. Babies valued more. This is, in fact, how I've been rubbing up against this subject again as I'm working on a book on parenting. And so in writing the section in the book on infancy and parenting, you know, babies, you run across the fact that, you know, in our culture, over the past 50 years, a decision has been made by the overwhelming majority to go to two-income households. And that's now the norm in the United States. About 70% of married families are two-income and growing rapidly. So it's going to go to 190%. I think we should resist that. And I argue in the book that this is a big mistake, that we should do everything in our power to avoid needing two incomes, especially during the formative, most critical period of our children's lives, birth through their toddler years, where so much damage can be done, and mysterious damage that is not resolvable. Terrible, terrible risks that people are taking with their tiny babies and children. When we began having children, I'm going to read you some of the text from it. We both felt strongly that Holly needed to stay home with the kids. I was newly out of grad school and only beginning to establish a small business. My income was in the 8,000 range. In 87. And of course the dollar was worth a lot more then, but not that much more. That was a pitiful income. And you know, our business was just barely profitable. And so to decide to go to one income was a really an act of faith for us. We're gonna find a way. And God blessed it, and our business started earning more, which helped a lot, but we still had to be pretty careful, definitely living tight. We drove old cars and lived in an apartment and later rented a small house. We ate cheap food, went out, always without clothes, new clothes, thrift stores, those are okay. Dollar for a shirt. Rarely going out to eat or see a movie. If we did see a movie, we went to the cheaps, we went to the dollar movie. And just by waiting, that was kind of a rejoicing. By waiting, you know, a few weeks, instead of paying $8 a head, you're paying $1 a head. What a deal. What are these idiots are paying $8 a head for that? It's surprising how much you can save if you work on it. We lived poor and we lived happy. I look at those years as great years. The belief that having a big immaculate house will somehow bring happiness to a family is nothing but a lie. Well demonstrated in millions of unhappy, wealthy families in America today. Instead of enrolling in all kinds of expensive programs and sports teams, we taught our kids to enjoy nature. Hikes, swimming at the river, observing and identifying animal species, exploring forests and streams, watching storms, fills life with wonder. There's so many things. I've always been partial. I like kind of like God's world more than the world of man. Getting out with a kid in nature. Oh yeah, this was called Low Banks. It's a hole that we knew about in the Olentangy. And right, you know, with a metropolitan city, here's an area completely isolated with trees around it, and that's Joe that I'm throwing up, and Jess is supposedly going to catch him. I don't know how well that worked out. We'd go up there on hot summer nights, beautiful flocks of flycatchers that would be working the river there, cedar wax wings. And I wish I could do this again. I'd like to do that again. But it's too late. We already had our chance. I'm glad we took that when we had it. And I would feel sorry for any family that was just too busy to do something like this. We went up there most weeks in the summer. The fact that I drove an old beater car with a bad muffler has never cost me or them a single night of sleep. And I probably saved $40,000 in today's dollars over those years by not buying an expensive SUV. For 20 years of driving dump cars, you save a lot of money. When you see how vulnerable and sensitive your baby is, you bring that new baby home, you will probably feel what we felt, a strong sense of protectiveness and total unwillingness to have someone else raise your child. I knew I could trust that task to no one, not trust it to anyone, but her mother or me. And that's it. Research later confirmed my impression that it's not safe to have someone else raise your baby. Here's a book to read on it. If you want one title, Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare, Behavioral Drugs, and Other Parent Substitutes. She's not a Christian. She is a feminist. A professor at Stanford, a very respected sociologist, Mary Eberstadt. And the research in this book is impeccable. She has done a scholarly piece, and basically, you know, our culture really doesn't want to hear this. And she's got a large section in there about how you're not allowed to say certain things in academic circles without facing severe retaliation and punishment, and that you're literally not allowed to study certain questions. And she shows powerful correlation between some of the worst features that are showing up in the younger generations today and when the majority of people went over into daycare. The study is there. I mean, they've basically shown the negative effects that it has on kids. Let's take a different example, okay? I'll read this. Leaving kids in a daycare facility or other care arrangement simply cannot match the nurture of mom and dad. At children's most vulnerable stage of life, parents are leaving them all day long to an unpredictable, hazardous environment. Secular claims that daycare is safe is just belied by the facts. And they furiously claim that when they show that children in daycare are more aggressive, more defiant. They say that they're actually stronger than their weak and passive home-raised kids and so on. So they spin the meanings. Okay, here's a Hallmark study in 1995 showing that during critical years of language development, children of affluent parents hear an estimated 30 million more words than children from poor families, which results in better language skills, reading comprehension for affluent kids. And that's a gateway skill. I mean, that takes you into all areas of academics, language skills. Okay, but check this out. Recent research has clarified these findings, showing that conversations between adult and children are most effective for changing the child's brain. They found that this back and forth conversation is actually far more critical to language development than the 30 million word gap. Trafton explains, the findings suggest that parents can have considerable influence over their children's language and brain development by simply engaging them in conversation. The important thing is not just to talk to your child, but to talk with your child. It's not just about dumping language into your child's brain, but to actually carry on a conversation with them. Yeah, so what you need to do is get down on that floor and get rid of that phone and get that little baby, you know, talking to you. When they're infants, it's making noise and cooing and imitating each other, which is already forming the idea of action and response. And then they start learning the words, and if you will sit down, they will talk. You're trying to develop your child's creative use of language, the ability to rapidly formulate sentences with appropriate vocabulary and syntax, which is the parts of speech. Healthy children acquire this ability primarily through conversations with adults. What is the real problem with children who are the poor? It's that they're ignored. They don't get enough direct attention. That's the biggest problem. Otherwise, you could have a machine spewing words at a baby and it would fix them up, but that's not the case. It has to be conversation. And the number of creative exchanges between conversation partners that correlates with enhanced language skills and visible enlargement of the speech centers of the brain. They're using functional MRI to study these. And this study was very persuasive. Children's early language exposure impacts their later linguistic skills, their cognitive abilities, and their academic achievement. Conversational experience impacts neural language processing over and above socioeconomic status or the sheer quantity of words heard. This is in Psychological Science article, and another one that they cite in Harvard Graduate School of Education research. Very recent, very authoritative studies, but think about that. So getting down there and getting that little kid talking to you, yeah. They will talk. The better your kids get at conversing, the more they like it. 3 to 5 year olds who have been raised to converse will happily enter into even lengthy discussions. You can say, I've got video clips of me having half-hour-long talks with my grandson. And fantastic, and you know, his language capability is astonishing. And that's what you get with parents who are, so, is your daycare center gonna provide that? No way. Even if they have 5, 6, 7 workers in that room, they can't provide this. And so God gave us a pattern, a mother and a father. And we need to comply with that pattern. And we need to also get outside of ourselves and minister to our children. You know, a lot of times it's not that you're talking with your child, it's that you're on the phone, looking at the phone, and you look over now and then to make sure nothing bad's going on. It's not this kind of linkage that we're talking about. Cost of daycare since 85. So good daycare nowadays is $10,000 a year per kid, or close to it. It's not that we really need the money. You hear, well, you know, both of us are working, we're just making the same thing that we used to with one of us working. Not really true, actually. Per capita GDP. Women's income increasing faster than men's, but this is rate of increase. They actually still earn less than men, but at least it's heading in the right direction. But the point is, people's general income in real dollars, in 1947 dollars, has risen by like 40%. Houses today are 50% larger in square feet than houses built in the 60s. There's really no sign that of anything other than we're wealthier than we've ever been. And that sense of, oh, well, we're just barely making it. We can hardly make it from one, you know, check to the next. Well, that's a lot of money being spent if that's the case. We're going to have to simplify probably a lot, downsize a lot, if we're going to get down to a point where we can enter in, get away from this crazy modernistic rat race chase, and be able to really invest in our families, in our babies. This is another study percent. So GDP per household, and then the mean and the median. Well, the mean can be thrown off because of super wealthy people that are making, you know, so much. But everyone agrees that our incomes are up in real dollars. Percentage of mothers and fathers reporting work-related conflict, work-family conflict. It's interesting. The males feel it more than the females, according to this. And these are dual earner couples with children. The Economist writes, the more cash-rich working Americans are, the more time poor they feel. Yes. That's in 2011. So being busy can make you rich, but being rich makes you feel busier still. This is all predictable. This is exactly what we would predict. The dynamics of sin, which is the vanishing returns of sin, of thinking that money, which Paul says in Colossians 3 that greed is idol worship. And so to think that another idol could take God's place, all it gives us is more thirst and more desire, less time available, so destructive. We know better than that. We are believing Christians. We don't fall for this at all. We actually have a large percentage of people in our church who have managed to eke out a one-income way of life during their children's young ages. And it's not everyone, but I think it might be the majority, which I think is really good, and I wish it was even more. As leaders in your home, you fill the normal function of leaders. Here's another area to think. Parents are leaders. God does not create a family as a leaderless entity. Leadership of the parents. What do leaders do? For one thing, they provide for the need of their following, or they show them how to provide for themselves. They definitely see that their needs are met. They provide direction. Yes, there are times for directive leadership. They provide motivation where there may not have been any. Were we able to win our kids over to believing in what we're doing, that it's good, that it's exciting, that it's enjoyable? They become motivated. It's our job to do that. And also protection, a key component of good leadership. Jesus talked about the hireling. He sees the wolf coming, and he abandons the sheep. He doesn't stay and fight the wolf to protect the sheep. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Well, let's focus on that last one, protection. One thing that we need to protect our kids from, particularly when they're too young, to protect themselves. So from the cradle up through their grade school years, they're really pretty helpless. You can't expect them to protect themselves at that age. They're going to be under daily attack, and God has placed you, the parents, there to protect them from these attacks until they're able to protect themselves. For instance, ideology. As parents, you are the intellectual and spiritual gatekeepers for your family. You're also their teachers, superseding any other teacher they'll hear, assuming you're invested. If you're absentee, I don't know whether that's true. As a good protector of your kids' minds, you're going to be on the watch for false views. For example, materialistic greed. Children today live in a culture where getting ahead financially and career-wise is the be-all and the end-all. That's what it's all about. This frenzy to attain will come hurtling toward your kids with great force from the school, from relatives, from media, and from their friends who are steeped in this worldview. So here is this river of consensus moving in this way, and you're saying you're going to move exactly the opposite direction from that. You're going to move towards simple living. That's not going to be easy. This will require some really creative and persistent parenting. Naturally, non-Christian families don't follow the pattern Jesus taught, but surprisingly, neither do many Christian families. Such parents are practicing Christians, but they've been penetrated by the values of the world system, usually without realizing. Yes, usually without realizing. These worldly families have all the latest gizmos, expensive phones and fashions. Their kids' constant babbling about cool cars or other possessions signals that their hearts long for riches. That's what they're fascinated by. Their parents apparently haven't lifted a finger to guide their kids into a spiritual mindset in this area. So it's funny, you see kids coming into ministry and youth ministry, and some of them are just awesome. It's incredible. You can tell those parents have done a fantastic job. Others, totally clueless spiritually and all about the world system. Why is that the case? Why are they so different like that? I'm very resistant to the idea that it's the kids innately is just more worldly. I don't think that's it. Parents need to win the argument between the way of Jesus and the world system. And the place to start is with grade school age kids. You'll be too late if you try to begin your instruction later. So these are kids whose, you know, boys whose voices haven't changed. We're getting there first is important. That's a key advantage that we have as parents. We get to get there first and get our view on the record and get them persuaded of that before they get rocked by this other. Suppose you're watching a TV show and an ad comes on showing rich people dancing around and socializing around a ritzy swimming pool. You know, I don't know, Budweiser. You know, we've all seen the ads. You could scoff that foolish people fall for ads like this because they think that riches are going to make them happy. And you will even get this, oh, Dad, shut up. But, you know, I let the critiques fly. It's important as they're observing and watching the things that are taken for granted and really imbibing those as values into their heart that they're being shown a critique for that, how the believing Christian looks at that very thing. You're driving through a rich neighborhood, $500,000, $750,000 houses. And so you comment, you have some commentary. Most of these people are probably unhappy. I know some of them are in our church, as a matter of fact. They're divorced. They must be foolish to spend so much money on themselves. If we had that much money, wouldn't we try to use some of it to care for the starving kids in our world? Would this be the best we could think of to do with our money? Get your kids thinking along those lines. Yeah, and they become zealous that they want to help the children and become givers, saving up tubs of money that they're going to give. Very realistic. And be sure to show them the world poverty through photos, video coverage, or maybe even take a trip to Mexico or somewhere where they can see what real poverty actually is. What do they call those snow bubble things? And we're of affluence. You never really see anyone that's that poor. Most of our kids, so we have to expose it to them, make sure they're watching appropriate material. Gratifying self through money is what our culture believes in. Why? They don't know anything about God. I have to make that case with my kids. We're different than that. We do know about God. That's why we don't fall for things like that. And we got to get that word out, because people are going to be hurt if they don't realize this is the wrong way to go. Now is the time to begin teaching simple living as a direct counterattack to materialistic greed. So we have an antithesis that we have to critique vigorously. There has to be a negative antithesis that's strong. I'm convinced we can't just use positives here. There has to be a negative too. But the positive part is why we believe in simple living. And we have to make that case to our kids. We're not going to go like your friends. Teach it as an ideology. This is what we believe, not just as a necessity, like this is all we can afford. You see the difference there. Yes, we could easily afford that, but that's not where we're going to go. That's not our direction. We don't need it. That's the point. Any purchase, you know, you need a justification. Why aren't we going to buy it? No need. That's all the justification you should ever need. Well, the ethical principles behind simple living include things like the idea that indulging self with money is a sin, actually, and it's foolish because it doesn't reflect God's values. You could teach that using the parable of the rich fool who had to give an account, and right when he had reached the summit of his richness, and he went to hell. We have a responsibility to the poor. We can teach Matthew 25, where Jesus spoke forcefully on that issue. If we always take money that could be used for legitimate need and we waste it on expensive junk, then we're bad stewards. Do my kids believe that? Pretty soon they're going to be out of my house. They're going to be controlling their own life. Okay? It'll be internal control, not external control. Hopefully, before they ever leave my house, they're already controlling themselves. They're already governing their own worldview, and they believe it in their own right and fight for it, because that's what it's going to take. It would be foolish to spend more than necessary for something. Why would you spend double what you can get for this? Why spend $30,000 for a new car when you can get one that drives just as well for $8,000? It's got AC. It's got a good stereo. There's nothing wrong with it. Show me why I need something better than that. People who waste like that show that they're mentally weak and easily manipulated by advertising or fads in our culture. That's an argument that we have argued with our kids. They're intellectual weaklings. They just get swept up in this. They don't know what they're talking about. And the next thing you know, that dominates their life. With the extra time you save from not working all the time, you'll probably be able to do some repairs instead of always replacing things. And you'll be able to teach your kids how to fix things. In civil living, spending is always the last option. If we can't fix it, if it's history, it's just no good anymore, then let's go buy a new one. Point out to your kids that the newest, buying newer cars is a poor investment. They're overpriced, they rapidly depreciate. You can easily waste tens of thousands on a fancy car and then double your loss by borrowing the money for it and paying interest. Meanwhile, you could just get a reasonable used car that runs well, and then you'd be a good example to your kids. Maybe they'll imitate you. Simple livers, you'll learn to enjoy spending less. Going to the thrift store is fun, and then the clothes are less than a tenth of the cost of new clothes. I remember my teacher kid that fashion is a concept for the idle rich who like to waste money by throwing away perfectly good clothes. Creative people can make nice looking retro or other outfits from without spending unnecessarily. I remember my daughter laughing that her friend had paid $28 for the same top that she got for $2. That is worth, that's a triumph. Food deals at discount groceries taste just as good as wasteful prepackaged dinners. Learn to cook and enjoy it. Teach your kids to cook. Make it an activity that, you know, you and me are going to cook this for the rest of the family tonight. Make that a time. The reason we don't do this, the reason we're using the prepackaged, lean cuisines or whatever, is because we worked all day, both of us, don't have time to cook, and so we're bringing a pizza home or whatever. For some of this, we're gonna have to go simple in order to be able to do this stuff. Avoid going out to fancy restaurants unless absolutely necessary. And that, usually, hopefully, when someone else is paying. Some people say maybe I just come by this because I'm Scottish, and this is part of Scottish culture. They like to call it being thrifty. But I don't think so. My family didn't follow this. They always bought the best, and they believed in careerism, and they showed me a mansion on Olentangy River Road that was like something. I think it was actually a monastery or something, but it was just this huge house. And I remember being told, if you become a doctor, you can own a house like that. So they changed their ways later. But that's not how I was raised. Various possibilities. Maybe taking a job that pays less and requires fewer hours, so you'll have more money to invest in relationship and ministry. We've had a number of people do that here, professionals. Step out from a lawyer, stepping out from a partnership track to do law for a corporation. He's perfectly well off, but without all the pressure they were putting on him that was wrecking his home life. Couples live on only one income for the sake of their children, even if it means moving to a smaller house and driving well-used cars. How about the seven Joseph's plan with the Pharaoh? Seven fat years pay for the seven lean years. If you're dinks, dual income, no kids, you're probably making fantastic amounts of money, you know. And you can save that money. I know dinks that have saved $40,000, $50,000 now, cash. Now they had their first kid. She's dropped her job. It doesn't have to be her, although, frankly, the mom has key advantages, especially in the infancy, which I explain in the book, if it ever comes out. And then they can draw on those savings, draw down every year, you know, some thousands of dollars, and then it makes up, you know, the shortfall. Plan ahead. Stop saying that we're barely making it when, in fact, we're the richest level of income in the world, both now and throughout history. If we're barely making it, what does that say about everyone else? Okay, I'm going to skip some of these. The direct connection between simple living and the spirituality of the church, important to consider too. When the church is caught up in the world system, Jesus described how the worries and cares of the world and deceitfulness of riches choke out the fruitfulness. And then once we accept that modern people just don't have time to do what the Bible calls us for, we can yap all we want, nothing's gonna matter. It's just gonna be a dead church, and that's all there is to it. That's happening all around us. Start young, get yourself a reasonable career that provides adequate income without interfering too much with more important priorities. You guys that are young here should be getting a decent career. It's going to put food on the table. Avoid buying a house at the upper limit of what you qualify for. Some of our people have made a mistake here. They're dinks. So, you know, I'm making 55, she's making 55, so we qualify for a $250,000 house. And so we buy that, and the, you know, the real estate agent is like, it's going to appreciate better. Is this a good real estate move? He wants as much as possible for his commission. And so they wind up sinking roots into an affluent neighborhood without realizing that this is going to really create serious problems for that family later on, and they're going to feel stuck. They're going to feel like, you know, now we have to keep working because we have all these bills. Think ahead and realize not to make those kind of moves. Debt management's important. Avoiding private student loans as much as possible. This is getting really harder to do. Some of it can be alleviated by slowing down a little bit. It's strange to see kids today taking huge numbers of hours, way more than a normal four-year schedule, for no clear reason. And if they went on and off semesters and worked and saved, they could make some of that. Parents usually aren't helping. I don't know why that is. Don't borrow money for degrees that don't issue in a career. My buddy recently found out he's getting engaged to a lady who's halfway through her degree at Otterbein and already $50,000 in debt for an art degree. You know how many people are trying to do art? We see a philosophy, degrees in philosophy, you know, $50,000 in debt. Learn to save up and then buy. A practice that's kind of gone by the wayside, but you put money aside, you know, $100 a month, and then you buy your $2,500 car after a couple of years and no debt, no borrowing. You should save up an emergency fund. Mac taught me that one. I never used to do this, but because I was in debt, for one thing. We fell into debt when our kids were young. I don't regret it. That was the time when we needed the money. We don't need it now. And but still, keeping $1,000 in the bank for that, you know, the transmission or the big expense that suddenly hits you. And that's when people start hitting the credit cards and piling up bad debt. If you're having trouble with self-control, use a debit card instead of a credit card. And if you're losing control, get credit counseling. Go in and get your study, your budget, and get a plan. It really works. Very helpful. You need to keep giving. People who put God first in their personal finances, you need to be able to tell your kids this, that we give this percentage because we believe in that and we trust that God will see that we have enough money, and he always does. I like going camping. Camping is not as expensive as hotel trips. And when you go to the Disneyland trip and you're in the hotel and all that sort of stuff, everyone just spends their time staring at the television. If you do have to get yourself a setup for camping of some sort. When you're out in the woods, you're sitting around that campfire talking to each other. It's totally different concept. And planning, we would go on adventure camping trips where we would plan the next night where we're going. Each new campground for little kids is like a new world to explore, running around, checking out the playground, and so on. We devoted a lot of time to this, and you could notice during the course of a two-week camping caravan episode, a noticeable difference in the children, that they aren't fighting with each other, that there's a warmth there. There's been bonding that happened, and I became a big believer in it. Developing sales resistance is a basic skill for simple livers, not suckering for advertising. Learning to evaluate need, learning to repair broken things. And yes, from our kids, we want them to give us good grades. B is a good grade. It's above average. The idea of seeing kids grounded because they brought home a B for the first time, including grounded from fellowship by Christian parents, that's really a pretty bizarre value system. Picking a sport rather than going out for every sport so that that's all you do. Prioritizing fellowship, God, family time, including you need to invest into the family and be here when we're to hanging out. And then you can play and mess around or whatever you want to do. Doing a time study can reveal that you have a lot more time than you thought, and you can identify ways to start to cut from the bottom. Well, those are all ideas. I don't think I'm going to get any more. There are a lot of advantages. And we already went over some of these, though. Great. Simple living. I guess we got a couple minutes if somebody wants to ask something. Okay? Right here, right?
Thanks. So, a lot of people can be, like, really sensitive about, like, this topic. So, like, first off, how do you... Like, what's a good way to, like, come up to somebody and, like give them advice based off of, like, this kind of approach? And also, like, what do you do if you, like, get an inheritance that's, like, with a big, like, that's, like, for a big amount of money, but it's, like, much more than you need, but there's, like, no immediate way to, like, deal with that in a way that you see fit?
Yeah, well, the inheritance, the big inheritance thing is something that's more and more common. We're going to all be facing that. One thing you can do is put it in a trust fund so that you can dole it out as needs arise rather than just dumping a huge sum on some ministry that's going to mess them up. Yeah, definitely you would want to get counsel from a pro on how to do that. You know, I think in approaching people with this, I find that you can definitely lecture on it in public and teach these passages that we've looked at, and people are receptive, including non-Christians, who hear it and resonate with it, and they realize that there's something wrong with what they're being told, and that there is an underlying strain of doubt that postmodern young people have about this program chasing the moon career-wise and all that sort of thing. And we get a lot of people that are pretty responsive to the message. That's going to have to be it. We're over our time. We just want to save a minute to pray. God, we pray for our financial lives and our families, our ministries, Lord. We want to balance our life in a way that's pleasing to you. God, enable us to spend a little bit of time thinking about this and reading and just praying so that you can show us whatever changes you'd like to see us make. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.